Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 17th of April 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic victory of World War II and the soon to be released Churchill's Body Count, and also I do believe we might have a video on Stalin coming up soon as well, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening, yes. Sir.
Good evening, sir. Hopefully tonight it's going to be uploaded.
Excellent.
It's a short one, but it explains why, well, it isn't what I believe, it's the fact that Stalin was a Freemason and they could argue with me all day and all night. But I think there's enough there to show that quite capable of being a Freemason and everybody around him was.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, when you look at the way they have these professors, not professors, but people that are pop stars or whatever, and they say, well, we're going to make you an honorary professor of a university. I think if you've got somebody like Stalin, even if he hasn't been in a Freemason all his life, as soon as he gets to a certain position, they're going to be wanting him to be a Freemason.
Yeah.
And they'll accelerate him through the ranks, as it were, I would have thought.
Well, yeah, I mean, it applies in most careers of power and influence that get to a certain point where you need to be in the brotherhood. But besides that, I haven't been tonight because, believe it or not, this wonderful government, which thinks so much of its population, has been working so hard to save our lives. On the same week that the virus deaths have increased, they've decided to pull the 80% payments what they've been making with the firm, what my wife works for, who have decided to pull the 20% that they've been chipping in and said, if you don't go to work, we'll class it as unpaid leave. And obviously, she can't afford to stay off work, so she has to go to work at the height of the virus. Well done. I love this comment.
So while they're telling everyone that they're paying 80% of the wages so that people can stay home from work, your Mrs. Company has said, well, we're not doing that. She's got to come to work. That's disgusting.
Yeah, and they're saying it's a safe environment to work in and there's a pair of gloves.
Well, I would suggest she wears a mask as well. How can it be safe if she's working with other people there, breathing the air?
Well, why would she need gloves?
Yeah, if it's safe, why would you need gloves? This is the thing, they're telling us that we don't need to wear masks. Well, why do the nurses need to wear masks then when they're around people that have got it?
Exactly. I mean, it's got to a point, do I believe a word this government says? I mean, have I ever really?
Well, I think they're very, very incompetent, aren't they? I think that's what we've learned from this.
Well, that's a compliment in a way. I could think of a lot worse.
Yeah, well, you think, is it planned? And I know a lot of the time we suggest that, you know, a lot of these things are planned, but there's also a large amount of incompetence there.
I just wish when these people come on TV and they start giving out whatever they say, there's a red light above them, and every time they tell a lie, the light goes off. That would be interesting.
Well, we're here to expose the lies, Dennis, and we're going to expose lies about the Third Reich tonight, but just for a change, we'll expose lies about the Third Reich. Yes, there's more to be exposed yet. I just wanted to say before we started, we've been repeating Carolyn Jaeger's Study Hour, which she made with Hadding Scott. It's a fantastic series. I missed it the first time around. There's about 50 parts to it, and it's Carolyn Jaeger and Hadding Scott, and they basically go through Henry Ford's book, The International Jew, chapter by chapter, talking about basically what happened a century ago. And it was the changing of music so that was commercialized. The theater was burglarized, the way that the Jews took over Hollywood, all of this. And they go into all of that. And it ties in with a lot of the stuff we talk about, Dennis, when we've talked about Bernard Baruch and the Versailles Treaty and all of this. They go into all of that. And it's just a fantastic series because they don't always agree on everything. And it's well worth listening to. And I'd recommend any of our listeners.
That's cool.
Checking that out.
Correct me if I'm wrong or not, I mean, you may know, you may not know, but I heard that Ford, after the war, had to apologise for what he said about the Jews.
I think they did force him to. They did some kind of a court case on him and got him to make some kind of apology. But the basically it was a newspaper that he put out called the Dearborn Independent, and he paid for private investigators and for journalists to investigate what he saw as a Jewish plan for domination Jewish plan for domination of the American government. And he hired these detectives and these journalists, and he reported on what was going on. And it's just very interesting, you know, not from a conspiratorial point of view, but just from learning how the world changed, how America changed a century ago.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very important time. Just you know, just that after the First World War, Versailles Treaty, all of that is it's
well,
great.
Unfortunately, it was probably 50 years or too late. I think they'd already infiltrated, if not even before that. I think.
Yeah,
I know his intention. You know what I mean?
Well, I think they came over. They tried to change the Immigration Act, didn't they? And they failed. That's in there where they tried to change the Immigration Act, and it's basically how they were taking over things like music, things like theatre, shops, and then controlling the government, and the arguments that they were using are very similar to the arguments that that they use today. We're going to get into one of these arguments, funnily enough, that they use today, that actually the National Socialists used the other way around, which should be interesting to get into. But again, just before we get into what we're going to get into tonight, which will be a continuation from what we were talking about last week, the Protestant Church in Germany, I just wanted to give a shout out to Rare Book Club again on Twitter. You can find him at rarebooksww2, and he's got a collection of extremely rare books that you won't find on archive.org, and if you send him a donation, he'll send you PDF copies of the book that you want. Or if he wants to buy a new book, a rare book, you can send him a donation, or you can send him £80 and he'll send you PDFs of everything that he's got. He's a really nice chap. You have to actually ask to follow him because it's not publicly viewable. But that's Rare Book Club on Twitter. And that's where I got this book from that we were looking at last week that we're going to continue this week. It's called God Among the Germans by the author is called Paul F. Douglas. And he was writing in 1935. And this was before the war. And this isn't a propaganda book. It's an objective look at what was happening in Germany at the time with the church, because there was a huge revival in Christianity alongside the National Socialist Revolution. It's similar in a way to Wales had a revival in the church at the turn of the century, around about 1900, and they had all these preachers that were baptizing, and there was a big revival in Christianity that didn't take place in England. It just took place in Wales. And the same thing was happening in Germany at the time when the National Socialists rose to power. And the really interesting thing about that was that that was the same place where Martin Luther was centered. And a lot of it was about trying to finish what Martin Luther started. So that's why it seems so important to this author, because it was the birthplace of Martin Luther. It was where the Protestant Reformation began, and now you've got like this secondary part to it, which was sparked off by the National Socialist Revolution.
So, surprise.
Yeah, well, we talked a lot about the Catholic side to it, haven't we, Dennis? But
it's
hard to find the Protestant side about it. And the first book I got from there, I could tell it was propaganda, because it was making out Rosenberg to be far more important than he was, and saying that he was involved in the church and telling the church what to do. And he wasn't. Rosenberg didn't have anything to do with that. And that's one of the ways you can tell if something is, if it's black propaganda, is if it tells you that Rosenberg was responsible for the church. But there's none of that in this book.
I think he told the Pope Hitler, said, although Rosenberg's got his views, it has no effect or has no official. It's not an official view of the National Socialists. He pointed that out because it's not supposed to know the church may have been worried.
Yeah, well, a lot of the time what they would do is they'd look at something that Rosenberg had written and they'd say, oh, this is the official view of the National Socialists. And it wasn't. It was just Rosenberg's thoughts that he'd put down in a book. It wasn't official NS teaching. Anyway, what we'll look at tonight is some of the ways that the Jews were treated. And if we've got time, we'll look at what actually happened with the Protestant church and when it became the Reich Church, which was quite an amazing thing. But before we get to that, the first quote that I found this really interesting. It's actually about university admissions. And if you think today, we're told we have to have diversity quotas, we have to have a certain number of people at the university that corresponds with their percentage of the population, and they're trying to do that with the police, they're trying to do that with everything. The Germans were the first to do that, the National Socialists, only they did it with Jews. And of course, Jews seem to be exempt from this today. They only make up 1% of the population, but they make up something ridiculous like 60% of the students at Harvard. Yeah. So this is a National Socialist affirmative action. The law promulgated on April 25th, 1933, to prevent the overfilling of the schools and higher schools beyond the limit of compulsory education required the size of the student body to be limited to the need of the various vocations and to students who could profit by the training. So they only wanted people who were intelligent enough to do the training. And they only wanted people that actually had, there was a business to go to at the end of it. So there wouldn't have been, I don't know, David Beckham studies or Star Trek studies in the National Socialist Universities.
I'm sure there were.
Under Article 4 of this law, the number of Jewish students and faculty members was not to exceed the proportion of Jews in the total population of the Reich. Jewish children whose fathers had fought at the front in the war, as well as offspring of marriages contracted before the law became effective, when one of the parents of two grandparents were of Aryan descent, were excluded from the operation of the law. The law promulgated on April 7th, 1933, for the re-establishment of a professional public service contained in Article 3, Section 1, the clause that officials who are not of Aryan descent are to be retired. Honorary officers are likewise to be relieved of their duties. This law did not apply to officers who held their positions on August 1st, 1914, or to those who had fought for Germany and its allies at the front in the war. Further exceptions for officials in foreign countries were permitted by agreement of the Minister of the Interior in consultation with departmental ministers or the highest boards concerned. Under the law, lawyers of non-Aryan descent could have their right to practice withdrawn under practically the same conditions and subject to the same exceptions as applied to civil servants under the law just cited. By the end of May, decrees extended the application of the Aryan law to the Army and the Navy so that every officer, non-commissioned officer, and enlisted man in the Army and Navy who could not prove documentarily that he was of Aryan descent was ousted from the service. Subsequent interpretations made it clear that Jews were to be excluded from the exercise of any influence upon the cultural life of Germany, although they were to have an area of freedom in the commercial affairs. So it's not like they were being stripped of their ability to run businesses. They were just told that you can't be subverting our culture with your culture, basically. And the university thing, I mean, that's just common sense, isn't it? That they shouldn't be able to take up more spaces in the university, which of course they do today. But the idea that the National Socialists were doing this, they were saying, well, we only want you to have your percentage of the population in the university. That's exactly what they say today, isn't it?
Yeah.
About the minorities. Yeah. I was quite surprised to find that. And obviously, the fact that they had to do that shows you that Jews must have been massively overrepresented in the universities as students and faculty members. Otherwise, they wouldn't have needed to do this.
Yeah, you're right.
So the fact they did it shows that there was...
Well, they'd have to do it in America today, wouldn't they? If somebody came to power exactly the same, because they're overrepresented.
Well, this is the big scam, isn't it? Because in America, they will say, well, we've got to have proportional representation. We've got to have more blacks and more Asians in the universities. And then when they say whites, they include the Jews. They include the Jews as whites. So
when it suits them.
Yeah, when it suits them. And it's the same with in the television. When you look at how many Jews are involved in the television, and if you were to say, well, shouldn't they only be making up 1% of the people on the television, they'll claim to be white and say, oh, no, we should be making up 85% or whatever. So it's absolutely fine.
Well, it wasn't long ago that there was actually argued the case that Jews didn't run Hollywood. How crazy is that one?
Yeah, they don't like it when we say that. They say it. They brag about it.
Yeah, they do.
But when we say it, it's anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Well, the next little bit about the Jews I've got here that I thought was interesting is the removal of the Jews from the German church. And the reason why I thought this was particularly interesting is because it reminded me of the Inquisition, which was removing Jews from the church because they were subverting the church. And that was in 1400 onwards.
That was a plan, Mary, to infiltrate and subvert.
Yeah, there's that... there's that famous letter, isn't there, that says infiltrate the churches and we'll subvert them from within. It was from, he's supposed to be the king of the Jews or the prince of the Jews.
Secret Masonic tricks in there, yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they did. And they ended up, they said, well, we're Christians now and we've joined the church. And then they were still following the Talmud. They were still doing Talmudic things. So they had to have an inquisition to investigate them to see whether they were real Christians or whether they were still behaving like Jews. And that's what the Inquisition was. And when they discovered they were still behaving like Jews, then they would remove them from the church. And then you've got the National Socialists and they're doing the same thing, basically. You know, it wasn't something new. I've got the quote here. While the constitution of the National German Evangelical Church was ratified without the inclusion of an Aryan paragraph, Bishop Meuler made it quite clear in his address at Wittenberg that equality before God does not exclude inequality among men, as God had created them. The new church law of the old Prussian Union contained provisions which were almost identical with the rules which were being laid down for the secular officers and institutions of the German Reich. Article 1, Section 2 stated that persons not of Aryan descent or who are married to those of non-Aryan descent are not permitted to be called as ministers or to accept offices in the general church administration. Ministers and officers of Aryan descent who contract marriages with persons of non-Aryan descent are to be dismissed. Section 3 based the determination of what Aryan descent is upon the law of the Reich. Article 2, Section 2 required that ministers or officers who are not of Aryan descent or who are married to persons of non-Aryan descent are to be retired. So Jews that had become Christian were to have their own church, as we discussed last week. It's not that their Christianity or their professions of Christianity was being doubted. It was just that they should have their own church. They shouldn't be, in the German church. And of course, the international churches weren't happy about this. And what they did, they cited that Galatians chapter 4 that says there is no Jew or Gentile, there is no man or woman in Christ. But obviously that's not saying we are all the same. It's not saying men are the same as women and we can have transsexuals and all the rest of it. And God created these different orders, men, women, and the different nations. And that's what it means here by saying, that people were created unequal. We weren't all created equal. We may be equal before God, but God created man as unequal. As in different, as in diverse. You don't want to destroy the diversity by mixing it all up together. But reminded me of the Inquisition, which, so how can the international church say that this is wrong of the Germans to do this when it's what the whole of the Roman Catholic Church did for hundreds of years? 300 years they had the Inquisition going for.
Rather so, because they didn't want to be infiltrated, did they? So the only way they could find out was to actually interrogate them. But they were fair about it. I mean, you know, I've heard stories of, you know, people, they've been interrogated for three, four days and then let go. One particular converso was actually a converso Jew and got through the interrogation. It was only later when he left the country that he obviously was a Jew. He turned back to Judaism.
Well, I was looking up the Inquisition today and actually they looked like they were really good. You know, they went after pedophiles, they went after child abusers, You know, they didn't just go after heretics. They were basically like a police force, but a really good one that, you know, that stopped people from being immoral, as well as went after these heretics. And if you look up Wikipedia, it says the Inquisition was originally intended primarily to identify heretics among those who had converted from Judaism and Islam to Catholicism. And this is, you know, this is the same thing that the Germans were doing. It was Jews that had converted to Christianity, and they were investigating them to see if they were Jews. And if they were Jews, they were saying, well, you shouldn't be as a part of this German church, because it's a German church. You can have your own Jewish church. And then Wikipedia also says the Spanish Inquisition is often cited in popular literature and history as an example of religious intolerance and repression. But how is it religious intolerance? What they're saying is we don't want other religions in our church, subverting it. It's not intolerance.
I'll give you an example of intolerance compared to the persecutions of Christians in the Soviet Union, which was like 1,000 a day at times. The Inquisition was something like 10 a month. So there's a huge difference in what Stalin and his boys were doing to what the Spanish Inquisition were doing. And you can't even draw parallels.
And also, Spain was in the hands of the Muslims for hundreds of years, and the Jews were there in high positions. And after the Reconquista, when the Christians took over again, it's not like they kicked the Muslims and they kicked the Jews out. They allowed them to still be there. They were badly behaved. And they said, well, look, you can, you know, why don't you follow Christianity? We're setting you a good example. So some of them converted, and then they started badly behaving again. So they said, well, look, either you convert to Christianity and you follow up the same beliefs as us, or you have to leave the country. And rather than leave the country, a lot of them did convert, but it was a fake conversion. And that was why they had this Inquisition. And part of the rules of the church were that if anybody had been forced to get baptized, then it didn't matter. They could just go back to Judaism, because they didn't want people in the church that had been forced to become Christian. So these Jews that had become conversos, they hadn't been forced to do that. They'd deliberately done that so that they could subvert the church.
Another point, when you compare the Inquisition to what the persecution was of the Christians in the Soviet Union, was at least the Jews in Spain got a trial, whereas in the Soviet Union, if you were caught with a Bible, that was it, game over.
Yeah, it was all done properly and above board, and it gets such a bad rap today. And the reason why it gets a bad rap is because it was primarily targeting at Jews that were pretending to be Christian.
Yes.
Still getting involved in usury. I mean, usury was illegal then as well. The other thing is that they didn't want to have one group of people in the country that were allowed to engage in usury and another group of people in the country that weren't allowed to engage in usury. The Jews were, you know, expecting to be able to live by different laws to everybody else. So it makes sense.
I'm pretty sure that goes on in this country, because I'm not convinced the Muslims over in this country pay usury, because it's against the religion.
Oh no, the Muslims don't. But what was happening here is that the Jews were able to charge usury to the Christians, and they shouldn't have been allowed to do that. They should never have been allowed to do that.
Yeah. I pay it, and I should be paying it.
Yeah, well, we all pay it now. It's become part of our capitalist system, and that's why the capitalist system crashes. That's why it's crashing now. That's why we can't afford to have everybody take a month off, is because our system is built on usury. So 99% of it is all interest. Yeah, it does. But the people that were really against the Germans doing this was mainly the international church, but there was also a dissenting part of the German church. There was a dissenting part of the German church, and they were called the Young Movement of the Reformation. And quite different from this fighting point of view of the Young Movement of the Reformation is the concept of the Arian paragraph that was entertained by the moderate German Christians. This attitude is best set forth by Professor Emanuel Hirsch of the University of Göttingen He begins his approach to the problem with the assertion that the German and the Jew are two different peoples and lack every bond of inner understanding. While the efforts at assimilation had been in individual families and among individuals often successful, the Jews came to dominate the economic and spiritual life of Germany. As late as 1932, Germany was under the leadership of a foreign people. When the public became aware of this fact, the possibility of assimilation had come to an end. The new order of the Reich is based on the theory that the Jews are an alien people and cannot be assimilated. The Jew is placed under a guest law and dwells among the Germans as a foreigner. While this new relationship brings pain to individuals, the fate of single men must not be allowed to conceal the fact that this action is a necessary act of self-assertion on the part of the German people. By law of the state, Jews are no longer German citizens. There is no possibility of a Christian holding the false fiction that Jews who live in Germany and speak German are Germans. The Christians have a duty to see that the necessary divorce of Jew and German is not pushed off into metaphysics. The proper category in which to place the Jew is that of a stranger who does not fit in with the German type and who cannot be assimilated without harming the German nature. So this was the way that it was. This was the way that it was seen.
Well, I think that's why Jews get a lot of sympathy, because they don't really tell the whole story. Very few people knew what the Jews were doing to Germany, taking over the media and degenerate cinemas and etc. So, you know, when they just play victim and people don't know the full story, then they are going to kind of side with them, because that's nature, especially of our type of people. But they're very good at doing that, you know, always have been.
No, and the ones that had assimilated, it says that, you know, there had been successful examples of it amongst individual families and individuals. And they were covered in that first bit that I talked about in the universities, the ones that had actually fought during the war alongside the Germans, the ones whose grandparents had married them and they had become Christian and they'd shown that they had integrated. They were okay. These laws
didn't apply to them. Yeah, they were there to go for the right, weren't they?
But when you looked at them as a group, the Jews had come to dominate the economic and the spiritual life. I mean, when it says the spiritual life of Germany, that means there must have been a lot of Jews involved in the church that were directing the church and getting it to support communism, basically. That was the worst side of it.
With the Weimar, weren't they? What did that? 14 years to go to turn on that. And, you know, they've got the money, they've got the goals, they've got the bribery.
They were able to subvert a lot of Germany. But, I mean, this is just mainly concentrating on the church. And as we talked about before, there was a traditional side to the church and there was a revolutionary communist side to the church.
Yeah, liberal, yeah.
And the same thing was happening in the Protestant church. So you had these two groups. You had the Young Movement of the Reformation, who were the more Marxist types, and then you had the Deutsche Christian, who were the supporters of the National Socialists. They're the ones that had the cross and the swastika symbol.
This is why Hitler cracked down on them. He had to.
Well, you cracked down on the Marxist the side one. Of it, as we'll hear. Well, we won't get into the big split that happened tonight, but we'll see what sort of led up to it. So that was the position on the Jews. They were basically just being told, well, you're guests. You can't call yourself a German because you're not a German. You're a guest. They still had rights, as we discussed before, but those rights didn't include teaching Christians how to be Christians. You know, one of the things that gets me is when you watch a program about Christian history on the television and it's a Jew that's narrating it or introducing it all the time, you see that and you think, you know, how can they do that? How can they have the descendants?
I watched Moses the other day and that were straight out of Hollywood.
The descendants of the people that killed Christ, whose religion is defined by being anti to Christians, the opposite of it, and then have them introducing Christian programs and telling Christians how they should be Christians. It's chutzpah, isn't it? That's famous for. We're moving on to a slightly different subject. A lot of people have said that the Hitler Youth were pagans and that they were anti-Christian.
Yeah.
That's a common accusation, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. There's also like they're not Boy Scouts really. They're a second army coming, I've heard.
Well, they were like Boy Scouts, but they were following but they were taught more about their country and their folk than the Boy Scouts were. But the Boy Scouts were a very good organization, and Baden-Powell wrote positively about Adolf Hitler. He went to see Mussolini. He had something to do with Mussolini's equivalent of the Hitler Youth, the Balilla, I think that they were called. And Baden-Powell used a swastika, I believe. He had a badge, like a scout badge, that was a swastika. So there were similarities between them.
Yeah, but I agree. It's just that there's a bit of a, you know, the way they tell the story, like there's an undercurrent with the Hitler Youth, which is ridiculous.
Well, they tried to make them out to be pagans and to be anti-Christian, and that wasn't true. I think probably similar to everything else, there was probably a minority that were more interested in pagan things and that were anti-Christian, but the vast majority were Christian. And the leader of the Hitler Youth, Balder von Schirach, he is sometimes spoken of as being one of the pagans in the National Socialists. That's why I found this quote interesting. On December the 7th, 1933, a stocky young man stood before a cheering mass of youth in Stettin. "It is said," he declared, "that the German youth is Christian, but that its leader is a heathen and a heretic. The man who says that I do not believe in God lies, for if I did not believe in God and in a divine principle, I should not have become a National Socialist. I have the feeling that God is well pleased with the work of our National Socialist movement, and that he has blessed it more intensively than the work of the Catholic Christian Centre Party." And I'll just stop there, because what he's saying there, National Socialism is based on a religious principle. It's based on Christianity. It's based on a belief in God. And one of the people that pagans will put forward as being this anti-Christian is saying he would not have become a National Socialist if he didn't believe in God and in a divine principle.
Hallelujah. Yeah.
They were against atheism. Well, and what they were against the clericalism of the church. But not Christianity in principle.
Well, they felt the church was just being lazy. The Jews had put themselves into certain positions in the Bible, and there it's accepted. And the Germans obviously were furious because the church never really did anything against it.
This is what positive Christianity was, removing the Judaizing from Christianity. And Judaizing is the first heresy. It's written about in Acts, trying to turn Christianity Jewish. And if you remove Jews from within the church, then how are the Jews going to turn Christianity Jewish? They're not going to be able to. So that was a part of positive Christianity, was preventing these Jews from being able to do that. But Balder von Schirach, he continues, "We see in Christ that one who permitted himself to be beaten on the cross as a fighter for his kingdom, his faith, and his idea. We see in him the one who hated the Pharisees and drove them out of the temple. We have striven to be like this archetype. Every one of us has made his faith honourable when he is pursued for the sake of his faith. Men shall not therefore come and say that von Schirach has not understood the word of Christ. We have perhaps visited the church less than other folkic comrades, but we have gone into the red meetings of communists and at the risk of our lives have preached faith in state and in our leader." So again, what he's saying there is the same thing that you're saying, Dennis. You know, it's the National Socialists that went into Spain and stopped the slaughter of the priests by the communists. And what he's saying here is with the Hitler Youth, we've gone and we've witnessed to the communists about the positivity of National Socialism.
Exactly.
And again, he says it, and in our leader. So you can't say that he's an anti-Christian.
No, but they still will do, you know what they're like.
Yeah, they get mixed up between anti-clericalism and anti-Christian. And the clerics, as we said, the international church were against this, and there was a movement within Germany that was also against it. And their main reason for it was that they didn't like the fact that these baptized Jews had been asked to stop preaching in the churches, stop teaching in the churches, but when that was only what the Catholic Church had done for centuries. It was nothing different, nothing new. And then staying on the subject of the Hitler Youth and the Evangelical Youth are merged together, and the Evangelical Youth were the largest Christian youth movement outside of the Catholic Christian youth movement. The essence of the new agreement was that only Hitler Youth could be Evangelical Youth, and that the church was to limit itself to its primary task of proclaiming the gospel, while the Hitler Youth assumed exclusive right to take charge of all sports, entertainment, and cultural work. Therewith, according to the official statement, the church was freed from the burdens imposed upon it by the Marxist liberalistic state. The confessional youth, it was believed on the part of the state, was being misused for political purposes, and had received many socialistic and communist young members who hoped by their entrance in the organisations to find a means for expressing their political inclinations. Groups of church youth who had been annoyed by the union of communist youth within them rejoiced in the fact that henceforth the purity of their confession would be preserved by the condition of Hitler Youth membership, according to a statement of the Hitler Youth office. So there were communists that were trying to infiltrate these Christian groups, and the Christian group itself joined up with the Hitler Youth.
Well, they had carte blanche when the Weimar government was in charge. I mean, 14 years they could do that, which is exactly what the Centre Party did. But as soon as Hitler comes in, he shuts the door on them all, which is not really known about.
And part of National Socialism was everybody getting behind one leader and all working together towards one cause.
Yes.
And what they wanted to do was like a similar thing within the church. They wanted the churches to get together and get behind one person. They had this Bishop Müller, who they wanted to lead the Protestant church. And really, they wanted the Catholics to be together in that as well. But the Catholics had their separate bit. And they were basically, within the church, they were trying to mirror the National Socialist Revolution within the church as well, and that there was friction between these different groups, because you would have like the Catholic Youth group, and they had, because of the Concordat, they could still have their separate group, but yeah. Really they wanted everybody within the Hitler Youth, so that everybody was in that Hitler Youth, and they would guarantee to protect the Christian side of it and allow them to still have their Christian teachings and the rest of it, like they did here with the Evangelical Youth group. And also,
in America, the Jews, when they finally got enough power, they kind of they separated state and church, and even banned prayers in school.
And what you had here, you had the church becoming closer to the state.
Yes.
rather than being separate to it, and dividing up the tasks. So the church was no longer responsible for the sporting side of things and the entertainment and the cultural work. That was to be done by the Hitler Youth, and then the church was there to do the spiritual side of things, which is what they had always said, was that the church should be responsible for the morals of the people and the spiritual side of things, and the state should be responsible for the physical side of things, the physical health and the spiritual health. And yeah. this is where there was friction, because some parts of the church would be wanting to do parts that really the state was saying, look, that's you know, you shouldn't be doing this. There was friction. We can't say it was all perfect. There was friction between the two, but most of it, I think, was caused by the communist types, by the Marxist types, that didn't like this Aryan paragraph, because it excluded Jews, and you know we can see how philo-Semitic.
Most Jews are communists.
Yeah, and you can see how philo-Semitic so much of the church is today, with the evangelicals and the Zio-Christians and their support of Israel, and it wasn't that bad back then. But, you know, it's just crazy, really. What's wrong with Jews having their own Jewish church? Why do they have to be a part of the German church? Why do they have to be teaching German Christians how to be Christians? You wouldn't expect German Christians to be in the synagogues teaching Israeli Jews how to be Jews, would you?
Well, it's the same thing, isn't it? No, it's just crazy.
But that's effectively what you had.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a, I think it was a time about 1937 when they smuggled an encyclical from the Pope into Germany and heavily criticising Hitler and the National Socialists. And that was at a time when it was still fighting in Spain. You know, to undermine somebody who has obviously saved Franco, he's managed to get, he's got the Luftwaffe out there, got Franco's army back into Spain so they could take the communists on. I mean, why would you undermine somebody who is trying to save Catholic Spain? Doesn't make sense.
I think there was weight that was put on the Pope, wasn't there? From the Allies and the rest
I
of the world.
I think Roosevelt had a big thing to do with it, yeah.
And they were saying, you've got too close to this guy. And they're also saying that there were churchmen that were being badly treated. But the churchmen that were arrested, they were arrested for sedition. They were arrested for, you know, preaching a revolution against the National Socialists, which is exactly what the church was not supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
I was reading about some of these arrests today because they'll say, oh, that was proper. Today they'll say, oh, that was propaganda, and these guys were just locked up because they were Catholics. They weren't. They were locked up for promoting Marxist revolution after being warned.
Yeah.
But as we say, the union of church and state. On the morning of September the 27th, a procession marched slowly through the door of Schloss Kirchli in Wittenberg. And Wittenberg is Martin Luther's birthplace, or where he nailed his theses to the door. It was the same door on which, on October the 31st, 1517, Martin Luther had posted his epochal 95 theses. As the polemics of Luther brought forth the Reformation, so this early Wednesday worship service marked the close of an era in the ecclesiastical history of Germany and recognised the spiritual union of the administration of the Church of the Reformation and the National Socialist State of Adolf Hitler. In a sense, the procession which inaugurated the National Evangelical Church of Germany was symbolic of the vigour of the National Socialist Revolution. In the historic chapel came the flag of the Christian Church, together with the black, white and red tricolored banner of pre-Republican Germany, the Hakenkreuz of National Socialism, and the honored flags of the movement. The bishops and leading theologians of the new church, dressed in their ecclesiastical robes, were followed by church leaders in the brown uniforms of the party and by political leaders with top hats and morning coats. Then came the first detachment of theological stormtroops with full marching equipment, including trenching tools. Within a white field and a green border, the cross of Hitler was joined with the cross of Christ on the steel grey sleeves. As the congregation chanted "Wir treten zum Beten," the troops filed through the historic door and closed their ranks in the aisle of the centuries-old shrine. And this is the proper union of church and state. So the opposite of the way that America was going and Britain was going and separating the church from it, what they were doing here was forming a German church, the Reich Church, basically. And this was them honouring the union of it in the very church that Martin Luther put his theses. And this is why this guy wrote this book, because you're saying this is such a monumental thing that's happening here. You've got this final part to Martin Luther's revolution, is the church coming together with the state again, or how it should originally have been. And they created a new office of state bishop, which was created for Pastor Meuler, who was then called to it, and under him 10 evangelical bishoprics were created, which took the place formerly filled by general superintendents. So this was the Reich Church. This was the equivalent of the Anglican Church, but I mean, over here we have the Anglican Church, but we also have all these other little Protestant churches, evangelical churches, Baptist churches, Methodists, and what they were doing here in Germany, they were getting them all together, all the Protestants together under one church, which they had a vote over this, and the vote had actually won, but there were still people that weren't happy with it. We'll get into them a bit later. On the day before the opening of the National Synod in Wittenberg, the press office of the German Christians announced that the occasion realized the long-felt wish of the Chancellor for a single Reich Church. The realization of this dream, said the report, as acknowledged by Hitler, was due to the efforts of the German Christians. So I'll just stop there. So it was a long felt wish of Adolf Hitler to have this single Reich Church, not to abolish the church, not to abolish Christmas and bring in pagan festivities, but to have a single Reich Church that all the Germans were a part of, that was aligned with doing what was best for Germany and best for the Germans alongside the state. Do you want to comment on that, Dennis?
I mean, I compare it to the Germany today, you know, and even the rest of Europe, where, you know, there's not even God mentioned in the constitution of the EU, and probably never will be. So a totally opposite way of looking at things. Obviously, the German way was to embrace God and Christianity. And the EU is to leave him out and let's go man's way.
Well, the synod adjoined with a short prayer by Bishop Müller. In the meantime, the SA, the SS, the Steel Helmets and the Hitler Youth of Wittenberg had prepared a torchlight passage through which the bishop, the ecclesiastical ministry and the members of the synod proceeded to the city hall. Thus, the Evangelical Church of the German nation completed its organisation and another milestone was passed. And interesting about this, you've got the SA, you've got the SS, again, you've got these groups that pagans will tell you were anti-Christian, and they're all a part of this. Plus, you've got the church going through a torchlight procession. And again, we're told, oh, these torchlights, that's a pagan thing.
Yeah.
It was a Christian thing. It was part of the Synod of Wittenberg. It was the church that were getting involved in it. And walking through this.
Like I said, there's a reason for all this, and that is obviously the less people know about the war on Christianity and who is doing it, then the easier it is. Certainly, they don't want billions of Christians around the world to know exactly what's going on. And after World War II, there was a cover up. Massive.
Well, next, I've got some more information on Bishop Müller. Bishop Müller declared in his proclamation on the occasion of Luther's birthday, "If Protestant Christendom wishes worthily to honour the memory of the Reformer, its first duty is to see that God's everlasting truths are not obscured, but are preached loudly and powerfully, and in these days of lying and untruth are turned to practical account. Our people has been summoned by the Chancellor to proclaim before the world that it steadfastly supports its government. We German Protestant Christians humbly accept the salvation of our country by our leader Adolf Hitler as a gift from the hand of God. That the Chancellor defends the life and the honour of our nation has our cordial agreement. We are with him to a man in his pure and genuine desire for peace towards the other nations of the earth. For us, it means thankfulness and obedience to God if we stand firmly and invincibly behind our government in the struggle for our nation's honour and freedom. The real issue at stake is whether truth or falsehood is to govern the life of the peoples of the world. We in Germany live as on an island surrounded by armed nations. We are disarmed and defenceless, as is no other nation. They talk of peace, and they mean war. No honest and just peace among nations can be born of this unholy spirit. I therefore call upon all Protestant churches and congregations in Germany to realize the immensity of the responsibility before them and to take every opportunity to imbue members of the congregations with a sense of patriotic duty on the 12th of November." And the 12th of November is when they were supposed to have this ordination, and the Reich Church was supposed to begin, and it ended up being delayed again because of these Marxist factions. And we'll probably get into some of that in another episode.
Yeah, well, it sounds very much like they're trying to build the last bastion in what you just read of Christianity. And that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to shore it up, and not just in Germany, eventually.
Well, they understood, you know, the link between patriotism and nationalism and Christianity.
Yes.
And the importance of the truth. I mean, it's similar to what's going on today, isn't it, where they're talking about all these lies that are being told about them, and we have all the fake news today and the way that the media is lined up against
us
and makes us out to be the bad guys. And here you've got the head of the church speaking about it. and supporting the nationalist spirit and teaching his congregation to be patriots and to be patriotic, not telling them that they're members of a worldwide international brotherhood where everyone is the same, but that they're members of a brotherhood of nations where you have separate nations that, and you want the peace for those nations separately.
Yeah, that's, it's what I was taught when I was young, so it's no surprise. It's just hard to get all this information for the reasons I just gave.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, as I say, there was still these Marxists that didn't want to go along with this, and they tried to subvert it. And I mean, that's always been a problem with it, really. You know, once you'd had the Reformation, and you had all these different churches. I mean, this is why the Jews promoted the idea of having all these different churches.
Divide and conquer.
Yeah, because they you know, they've all got a different way of doing things, and they're not united. And if one's right, then that means the other one's got to be wrong. And originally, Christianity, and this is, you know, the way that Catholics always taught it, there's only one truth. And there is only one true church, and that was the Catholic Church. And that was the way that it was always put across until we had this Reformation. And once you had the Reformation, you had all these different groups. What Luther really should have done is try to reform the Catholic Church, not allow this split to happen that pulled the church apart. Because again, what they're trying to do here is get this one church together, but they were unable to because they had all these different factions that had been allowed to split off. And really, you think they're only following one Bible, they're only following one book.
And surely, that difficult, would you?
You know, and surely, you know, if you can show what the interpretation of that book is supposed to be, unarguably what it's supposed to be, then surely everybody should be following that. But that's not the way it goes, is it? Because we've got all this dogma and tradition that people have.
Communism is powerful propaganda. I mean, I can remember when I was a kid, actually, when one of my mates, I said, well, you know, workers against the bosses and all this kind of thing. And it's attractive when you're skinned, you know what I mean? And then obviously it runs a lot deeper, as we find here.
Well, yeah, this idea of getting jealous of people, isn't it? That person over there has got more than you, and it's not fair. You should just go and take it from him. That's the communist idea, isn't it? Like, workers of the world unite and take everything that the bosses have got. But yeah, you do that, and then you got nobody that understands how to do all the managing side of it, and the maintenance side of it, and the engineering side of it, and all the other bits of it. Much better to be all working together. I mean, the arm doesn't revolt against the leg, doesn't have a revolution against, you know, you should, a nation should function like a individual does, you know, with arms and legs and all functioning together, and it's the head that tells them what to do. The feet wouldn't think of, you know, directing everything in the way that the head does. And, you know, that's the way we should be. The feet aren't jealous of the head. They understand that they have a different role, and they do that role to the best of their ability. And that's the way
there's
the nation should be.
The Spanish Revolution in Secret Masonic Victory, where in that revolution, they tried to take the land off the houses of the landowners. And it got that bad that they had to just get out and run to the hills. But people were literally taking their stock and taking their animals and everything. It was just on a need-to basis. This is the communist way.
Well,
they need it more than we do.
Well, they certainly had a lot of communist subversion that they were trying to deal with, and particularly in the churches. You know, it was particularly in these churches, and I think possibly particularly in the Catholic Church because of that Concordat. So the Catholic Church was separate. It didn't have to become a part of the National Socialist State. And if the communists had tried to infiltrate parts that were a part of the National Socialist State, they would have been much more at risk of being found out than trying to infiltrate the Catholic Church. I think that could have accounted for some of the Catholic Church's later problems with them. I've got a comment here for you, Dennis, from the chat room for you to answer, from Anglo Falcon. He says, can you ask Dennis if this coronavirus is part of a controlled collapse of the financial system?
Well, it's an interesting one. It could be that it is a genuine virus and they're just taking advantage of the situation. What worries me is the fact that they brought out laws a couple of weeks ago where they could say now that anybody who dies of the coronavirus. And so, you know, there will be people dying of the coronavirus who don't really die of the coronavirus. And these laws have been brought, and other laws as well have been brought in, and they've never been mentioned. The BBC's never mentioned them. You know, there's been no mention on TV from the other side as well. That is always a concern to me when they're bringing laws in and nobody knows.
I think they're going to take advantage of it. I mean, they were going to need a bailout anyway. This is what Dr. Johnson's been saying. They were going to need a bailout, and this has come along, and it's a fortuitous coincidence that they can now use this and say, well, this is what caused the economic collapse, when we were going to have the collapse anyway because we had a usury-based system and because they were loaning out far more than they were ever going to get back in.
As they do, yeah.
And I think what they do is they look at everything and how can we profit from this? How can we make something from this? And the same as when 9/11 happened, and they said, well, now we can get all these laws in. And we should expect that, and we should be the same. We should be looking at this and saying, well, how can we profit from it? How can we use this to advance our narrative? And I think the best way of doing that is by pointing out that none of this would be happening if we just closed the borders. With China.
We're an island. Yeah. Easy thing to do.
And we've got the proof of it as well, because China closed the borders to Wuhan. China dug up the roads to Wuhan and wouldn't allow anyone out from Wuhan into China. And they succeeded in keeping the coronavirus from even getting to Beijing. It didn't even get to the capital of China. They managed to quarantine it and get rid of it. And if we'd done the same, if we had quarantined Wuhan and said, nobody's getting in, nobody's getting out, it all would have been over and done with. It would have burnt itself out in Wuhan, and we wouldn't be having this problem now. And the reason why we didn't do that is because we didn't want to be called racist. Donald Trump didn't want to be called racist. He was called that. He was called a xenophobe for wanting to quarantine China. You had that Tedros doing the same.
I was just going to say, I don't think this, especially in this country anyway, I don't think it's ever been about saving lives. It's just been about keeping the national health running. I don't think they care really. I've always said they don't care for the population. Unless there's a war, they'll give them a uniform and send them off to fight for it. But as a general, you know, the population is separate from the Jews and the elites. And they look on us as, you know, obviously subhuman. So at the end of the day, you know, We're going to suffer because we've just come out of this banker's debt. You know, we're supposed to have been paid for the last few years, and then we're going to go straight into another debt.
I think, you know, if they had allowed this to happen and you know, there had been a lot of dead people, we wouldn't have been able to work, and we're the ones that need to be doing the work for them. You know, they might have their banking things and their stocks and their shares and all the rest of it, but that doesn't actually create any value. It's only us that create the value. So any concern that is there for us isn't a concern for us individually. It's concern for the value that we can create out of things. And, you know, the proof that they don't care about us is all the dead in the nursing homes that they haven't told us about. It's only just coming out now.
These people are costing, in their eyes, they're costing the country because they're old. They receive money, they can't do any work, so they're, you know, victims easily for them.
You know, one of the estimates, 2 days ago, there was an estimate that there were 4,000 dead in the care homes, and the news is telling us, we've just built a 4,000-bed hospital, the Nightingale Hospital, and all there was in there over the Easter weekend was 19 patients. So that 4,000-bed hospital is completely empty. And we're being told that we've got 4,000 dead old folks in the nursing homes, and they're all going to be white because of the age they are. There wasn't any immigration then. And 4,000 is an underestimate, because in Europe, it was 46 to 56% of all the dead came from the care homes. So that's at least half of all the dead. So if they're telling us we've got 12,000 dead in the hospital, that means there's at least another 12,000 dead in the care homes that they haven't told us about.
And there's one more hurdle to get over, because I don't need telling so many times, but I watched tonight the guy talking, the secretary and whatever, and he said, other vaccines, you know, we'll be getting on with it, you know, as soon as we can. But he said it about 20 times. And you think, well, what's in a vaccine? I can't trust these people at the best of times.
Well, they haven't got a vaccine yet, have they? And of course, you know, you're worried about what's going to be in there, but I think they're going to be worried themselves because, you know, they haven't got a year and a half to wait doing the tests on it. And again, that's a way for them to slip in anything that they were worried that they were going to have to spend too long on before. They can slip that in there with it. It's, it's all up in the air, Dennis, but we've come to the end of the podcast tonight now, I think. So thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truth Will Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you in your gardens on lockdown. See you next week.